supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The Coast to Coast Eclipse paid a visit to Russellville, Kentucky this afternoon, greeted by a throng including a contingency from Temple University. Joining me with a recap is Abby Sidney's lead student in the group studying the heavens above. Abby, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Yeah, no problem. It was a great experience.
Well, what was the weather like during the peak?
We had completely clear skies the entire day. It's about 95 degrees out here in Kentucky. And during the actual eclipse, it seemed like it was sunset, nighttime, and it dropped about 10 degrees.
Now, of course, weather wouldn't have necessarily mattered because your project involved a hot air balloon above the clouds.
Yes.
Describe that effort.
So we launched a weather balloon, and it was composed of a couple of different payloads. So we had a tracking payload. And then we also had our system that was used for streaming. So we went up to about 100,000 feet with a camera payload. And from the ground, we could get to about 80,000 feet before we could lose connection. So about a year and a half long effort to do the entire project.
And truth be told, this was part of a nationwide collaborative called the Eclipse Ballooning Project.
Correct. So we were working with the University of Montana. And we were launching with the University of Kentucky as well as the University of Mississippi out here in Kentucky. So we are sponsored by the PA Space Grant Consortium, which is part of NASA's nationwide effort to support colleges across the United States.
What was it you were looking for?
So we were looking to just track the solar eclipse. So it's about 2.5 minutes of totality. And we could control the camera so that we could actually point it at the sun during totality. We did a test launch back in April for Lancaster, PA, and we were able to control it from the ground. And then, again, we wanted to do the same for the actual eclipse.
Of course, we're only a few hours out. What will happen with all the information you've gleaned? How long will it take to sort it out and make sense of it?
So we have probably about 45 minutes worth of video. Also stored locally was VR footage on a VR camera. So we'll also be able to get that back. But that'll take at least 5 or 6 hours just to process.
Now, apparently Russellville, Kentucky, has a regular population of just under 7,000. Did that population swell this afternoon?
Yes, it did. We were stuck in traffic for about 20 minutes after the eclipse on our way to go try and retrieve our actual payload.
What was the reaction of the crowd when the total eclipse first came into being?
Everybody was just shocked. There was probably about 100 people in the field all watching it, and everyone's laying down on the grass trying to look at this eclipse. And there was just a loud level of shock as the eclipse actually happened.
How about for you personally?
For me, and I think for our entire team, it was a lot of gratification. We've been working on this project for a year and a half, and just to see it actually in person was an incredible experience and once in a lifetime.
Above and beyond fetching data from a weather balloon 100,000 feet up, it's a different experience seeing it in person?
Yes, absolutely. We did a test launch back in April. That didn't even come close to the experience that we have today.
You know, there's another eclipse in April 2024. You plan to get involved with that one as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Helferty, our advisor, is already planning for 2024 and what experiments and how we can change what we did this year.
Well, congratulations for being at one of the many successful ground zeros. And we're looking forward to learning more when all the data come in.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Abby Sidney's, a Temple University student, the lead student in the group that went out to Russellville, Kentucky this afternoon for the total solar eclipse. Not so very long ago, it was a neglected community in North Philadelphia, and now Brewery Town has become one of the city's hot new neighborhoods, though its evolution comes with a share of growing pains, Keystone Crossroads' Annette John Hall reports.
By the time you hear this, 71-year-old Mary Griffin will have moved from the Brewery Town neighborhood she's called home for 52 years. She's been caught in the crossfire of developers eager to grab properties and longtime homeowners who have seen their taxes skyrocket because of it. And that leaves renters like Griffin displaced.
While my landlord, she sold her house. She didn't want to sell it, but, you know, she said the taxes was too high, and she couldn't afford it, so she said she had to sell it.
A lot has changed in the 40 years since Brewery Town fell victim to the divestment of the 70s and 80s. Back then, it was simply known as North Philly.
I said when I moved around on my block, it was like 50 of us with the kids and family and everything. And now it's only three, maybe four African Americans living on my block.
Now it's touted as Fairmount's cheaper, slightly cooler sibling by realtors. Brew pubs, coffee shops, and pet sitters coexist with established soul food restaurants and pizza joints on West Girard Avenue. Its close proximity to Center City, Fairmount Park, and public transportation is a magnet for millennials looking for affordable mortgages and convenience. According to Reinvestment Fund, construction and improvement permits have increased 116% from 2013 to 2015. It seems like a new building pops up every day, and it leaves African-American residents like Griffin, the ones who have hung in through the bad times, feeling like they don't belong.
And I can understand why people now think the pace has gotten crazy, because you now have tons of small developers up here, just every street doing stuff.
In 2001, David Waxman's development company, MM Partners, bought and renovated 8 shells on Girard Avenue and helped stabilize the block. Since then, he's developed hundreds of residential and retail properties in Brewery Town. He hopes all-purpose stores like Dollar Tree will stop the racial polarization on Girard Avenue. For as long as anyone can remember, African Americans have lived north of the avenue and whites have lived south.
And that's just insane. Why should there be a dividing line? So we felt that if you could bring retail that old and new residents would both use, people from north and south of Girard, you could erase this divide.
There have been challenges. A recent clash between neighborhood kids, members of a new gym at 25th and Girard, and police led to the hospitalization of 14-year-old Najee Tribble and the resignation of police officer Kevin Furman.
We're the outsiders in our own neighborhood now.
Tribble's father, Alfred Tribble, grew up in Brewery Town and believes some of the newcomers don't respect the old-timers.
You should embrace the neighborhood that you're in, first and foremost, because it's the neighborhood that you're in that's going to support you.
But others, like Michael Womble, owner of Crime and Punishment Brewing on Girard Avenue, believe the incident at the gym was not indicative of the neighborhood.
But in reality, a lot of these long-standing neighbors, like, they come through, they know me, and I know them. They're just like, Mike, I don't really care for your beer that much. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't bother me. What matters to me is that I know I've spoken with my neighbors, and my neighbors respect me as a business owner.
As the neighborhood changes, cities have an obligation to respect the needs of residents, says Ira Goldstein of Reinvestment Fund. He cites Pittsburgh as a city that has kept established community members in mind as it works to revitalize neighborhoods in transition.
They sort of proactively created long-term affordability for a significant number of housing units in that area, which allowed people to to hang in and benefit from the changes.
Even though she's moving, Mary Griffin is optimistic about Brewery Town's future. It's too bad she won't get to see it.
Now I'm going to move it into a place where nobody knows me, and I don't know if I'm going to be safe.
Annette John Hall, Keystone Crossroads.
Up next, we've got a back-to-school story for you. Now don't worry, kids. If you live in Philadelphia, you still have a couple of weeks until the bell rings. But the city's principals are already hard at work. Dozens of school leaders gathered in Northeast Philly earlier this month for an event that's become a back-to-school ritual. As WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron found out, it's a little bit like speed dating with a twist.
You've got the long rows of tables. You've got the roving herds of unmatched hopefuls. You've even got some awkward laughs.
Wow.
The big difference in this version of speed dating is that the people aren't talking about settling down and having kids. They're talking about helping kids.
So you said it connects to the curriculum as well?
Yeah, we have all our standards aligned here for all of our classes.
That's Lorena Tolson, principal at Adby Anderson School in West Philly, chatting with Tara Menz of the Stroud Water Research Center in Avondale, Chester County. Stroud offers tours and classes about water science, and Tolson wants her kids to get out and explore.
They need to put the boots on. They need to feel it, right?
The fresh air and just the quiet is so helpful.
This is what matchmaking sounds like at the School District of Philadelphia's annual partnership fair. It's a chance for principals and nonprofits to feel each other out and see if they can work together. And for Tolson, it's a way she can make sure kids at her mostly poor school in West Philly get exposed to things wealthier kids can access more easily.
I think we spend a lot of time talking about like the achievement gap and not necessarily always thinking about the resources and opportunities that our students could have to fill that exposure gap so that our students are basically competitive with everybody else that's in the city of Philadelphia and across the world.
This probably isn't something you think about if you don't work in education, but there are a lot of nonprofits and community groups working in Philly schools, 1,081 to be exact. Most are small, but add it all up and they provide critical services.
They're super, super, super important.
That's Shannon Reddick Smack, an assistant principal at Della Plain McDaniel School in Point Breeze.
Because unfortunately, you know, our students may not be able to experience a lot of these things that these partnerships have to offer.
Every administrator here is looking for something different. One says she needs grief counseling for students who've lost loved ones to violence. Anna Jenkins of Alexander Adair School in Fishtown says she'll jump at just about any opportunity. Her school has about 80 different partnerships.
Bilingual Butterflies this year, partnerships with the Art Museum. We've gone, you know, out to the Woodmere.
But Jenkins is still hungry for more help.
We're always adding on to what we're doing because we want to be the best.
This patchwork method for filling in the gaps creates its own problems. A lot of principals say they just don't have the capacity to juggle more partnerships, even if they're available. Luckily for Jenkins, one of her parents, Sasha Best, recently volunteered to manage all of the school's relationships. And this year she got money from AmeriCorps to do the job part-time.
And it's the best job in the world. I do it for free. That's how much I love it.
As it turns out, sometimes in Philly schools there are so many people who want to help that you need more helpers. Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
Some ex-offenders and men and women on work release are teaming up to paint a mural in Philadelphia's Feltonville neighborhood. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports the group is hoping the city can help find them a career in painting.
15 people are working in the basement of the Feltonville Recreation Center putting paint on parachute cloth that will eventually become a mural for the center. Kalo Reed says after spending time incarcerated, he joined the program. His only prior painting experience was kitchens and bathrooms.
I actually changed my whole lifestyle. I wake up 6 o'clock in the morning now. Gotta be here by 9, so gotta be here half an hour early before I get my routine on.
Artist Carlos Lopez Rosa says the group works on the mural in a paint-by-numbers format, filling in areas of parachute cloth with special paint.
The system is created so you, even if you don't have that much of experience for painting murals or art, you are able to paint it anyways.
Brandon Wallace says he spent time in prison for fighting and selling drugs. But now after working on his second mural, he feels he's developing a talent for art.
It feels good. Like I feel different. Like, I feel like a new person because I'm putting on art and murals and stuff with my friends. Like new people I met. It's more positive, you know, not negative.
Mayor Jim Kenney says he hopes the program is a stepping stone for ex-offenders to turn their lives around.
There's nothing worse and more frustrating than going up to our prison system and talking to young men and women who clearly are talented and clearly have the ability to succeed, and because of factors in their lives and things that didn't happen or should have happened, they wind up there. But when they get out, there is no reason for them to go back if we can provide an opportunity for them to produce and to contribute.
The mayor says the rebuild program, funded by a portion of the sweetened beverage tax, could help some ex-offenders find jobs that will give them another chance. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Today's solar eclipse was a spectacle shared by the entire nation as it made its way from Oregon to South Carolina. Situated around halfway between those two points was Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, who joins me live. Derek, welcome to NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Not a surprise that you chose the Show Me State. Well, what did it show you in Missouri, and where specifically were you?
Specifically, I'm at the Rosecrans Memorial Airport in St. Joseph, Missouri. This location is right on the center line of the eclipse, and it's in the zone where you have the longest amount of, or the greatest duration of totality. So I enjoyed 2 minutes and 39 seconds of totality today, and it was a truly spectacular eclipse because of the drama involved between clear skies and cloudy skies right up to the moment of totality.
A nail-biter, but did the skies actually part for at least part of that 2-minute-plus interval?
Well, this is what made it so dramatic, actually. It was a solid cloud deck right up to about 10 minutes before the last little bits of the sun was covered by the moon. It was raining even then, and after that, the deck was still very heavy, but the clouds thinned just enough to catch that last 10% of sunlight being consumed by the moon, and then we got a little bit more cloud cover, and then thinning out again just long enough to give us a great view of totality, in which I could see the corona, the outer atmosphere of the sun. I could also see prominences around the edge of the disk of the sun, and it was truly a dramatic and spectacular event, even with the cloud cover we had.
Of course, it was Johnny Cash who evoked the corona in Ring of Fire, but describe more specifically how it is that the outer area of the sun is actually much, much hotter than the interior.
Well, I wish I could describe that in some detail, but this is one of the things that scientists are trying to understand more about. The corona of the sun, that outer atmosphere, is very, very thin, very tenuous, yet its temperature is millions of degrees. The surface of the sun is only 11,000 degrees. So there's a conundrum, the disconnect, the incongruity between the surface temperature of the sun being so low and the temperature of the corona being so high without a mechanism we can immediately identify. So during solar eclipses, many, many more scientists can look at the corona and attempt to collect data that might help to make it better, make it easier for us to understand how it is that the corona can not just have the structure it has, but also have the very high temperature it does.
Derek, we spoke repeatedly in the weeks leading up to today's event about how this was unique to the extent that citizens across the country were going to help take part in explaining the science. What was the citizen-scientist ratio at the event where you were today?
Well, I'd say that most of the people that were here were just out as curious onlookers, people who have an interest in science, an interest in astronomy, that want to see a spectacular, real science experience or science event. And they were here today in vast numbers. I'd say I was here with maybe 15,000 of my friends enjoying the experience here. And there were a few that actually were trying to do science, but it might have been more difficult simply because of the cloud cover. However, across the country, Dave, along the path of totality, there were many, many projects conducted by citizen scientists who were collecting data of checking temperature, checking pressure, checking wind speeds, as well as hundreds of people viewing the eclipse, videotaping the eclipse from points all along the path, all of that data which will be assembled later by NASA into a much larger sort of look at the entire eclipse from one coast to the other.
Lastly, setting science aside, describe for you personally the goosebump effect. What's it like to actually see an eclipse relative to just observing pictures of it, perhaps?
Well, it's almost indescribable. It's a visceral experience. It's an emotional experience. It's a spiritual experience because here we are in the middle of the day. We'd been enjoying the bright skies, even though there was some significant cloud cover. But you can feel the difference in darkness as totality approaches. And then here we are, standing inside the cone, inside the shadow of the moon, watching the mechanics of the celestial machine work as the eclipse takes place. It really gives you a sense that there are bigger forces at work in the universe that are making these things happen. And, of course, here we could actually see that, watching the moon as it slid in front of the sun.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Now, before this afternoon's eclipse happened, a Philadelphia musician released a soundtrack to the 2.5-minute-long solar phenomenon. Raj Haldar, also known as Lush Life, created a track intended to accentuate the viewing experience. It's called Totality Piece. Now, unlike other songs about the eclipse, for example, by Bonnie Tyler or Pink Floyd, Lush Life's song has no lyrics.
We made a very concerted decision not to have vocals. It felt really weird to have any very distinct voice appearing as somebody is ostensibly looking up at this once-in-a-lifetime event.
Lush Life was inspired by ancient ideas about making music based on the orbits of the moon and planets. A larger project by him called Skull Eclipse will be released this fall. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.